Our next case is number 052745, April McMillan against Collection Professionals. Phillips.
May it please the court. I'm David Phillips. I represent the plaintiff appellant. I think the district court's own opinion is the proof of statement that was made by this court in Johnson versus Revenue Management, and then cited with approval in Walker versus National Recovery, which is federal judges are not the best judges of what an unsophisticated consumer may understand a letter to be. To paraphrase the decisions in those cases, what may be clear to a federal judge, a legally sophisticated reader, may be unclear to an unsophisticated reader. And here,
Mr. Phillips, I wanted to ask you whether the real gist of your argument is lack of clarity to the reader, in this case your client, or whether it's really that it's degrading or, you know, insulting. I mean, that may be perfectly clear, to be accused of dishonesty and the like. It's a somewhat different problem than being told you have to pay immediately and being told you have 30 days and being told things that all seem to be at cross purposes.
Your Honor, I think that this statement in this letter is actually closer to a legally untrue statement than a legally true statement with a capacity to deceive. I mean, this statement says...
Right, and I'm just trying to get at whether we're worried. I'm looking at where the district court reproduced the statement. Calling somebody, you are either honest or dishonest, you cannot be both, and all the rest of it, doubt of good intentions, prove your honesty, etc. Maybe you're just making alternative arguments, but I'm curious as to whether the deceit box is the right one to put this in, or whether the tendency to disgrace box, which the statute, of course, as you've argued,
sure,
also covers.
I think we're covered by both here. I think that the wealth of other reasons why someone would not pay a debt other than they're dishonest illustrates the problem with this collection letter on its face.
I think you're mistaken. It's the bounce check that they're talking about.
Well, in this case, there is a bounce check, colloquially a bounce check, Judge, but there's many reasons why a check may be dishonored other than someone's dishonest.
And yeah, but a reasonable implication might be that a certain amount of dishonesty. You mean you don't know your balance?
Could be. You don't know your balance. There's other reasons, Judge. The Tribune just had a big article on Sunday about a young lady whose identity was stolen, and all of a sudden she had $412,000 in mortgage debt.
I'm talking about in general.
I don't think you can give a generality. I think there are some people who bounce a check.
I spent a lot of time prosecuting people who bounce bump checks over the years.
Sure, and I know that was one of your concerns, Judge, when this court addressed whether bounce checks, as you phrase it, were debts covered by the Fair Debt Act, and you were very concerned about that. But there are many reasons why checks are dishonored that have nothing to do with honesty or dishonesty. You could have gotten a paycheck from an employer and put that in your bank account.
Anything is possible.
And it bounced.
Anything is possible. And we were all created 5 minutes ago with our memories intact, but generally speaking, that's not true. When I say we deal in probabilities, and probabilities, people write bad checks, are doing so, generally speaking, in bad faith.
I don't agree with that, Judge.
Okay.
I do not agree with that
hypothesis. Statistically, you're on unsound ground, but go ahead.
I don't think statistically I am. I think that when the Fair Debt Act was enacted, that was one of the things that was debated. Are people just deadbeats? Are we just protecting deadbeats? And there Congress said no. Most of the people have something bad happen to them, and they're not going around trying to bounce checks.
Most are, huh? That's what they said.
That's what they said, is there's a great wealth of people that had bad things happen to them. And that came out again when there was a debate about passage of the Bankruptcy Reform Act, which is
there's
a lot of people...
There's an empirical study done on the thinking process of people who bump badge checks Congress.
It was about debts in general, Judge.
Debts in general, I agree with you.
Right. And in this case, we don't have any factual... We don't have any factual development in this case as to why the check was dishonored. Was there a dispute over the goods? Did someone steal someone's identity? I have a client, Ms. Durkin, who was her husband was the subject of Durkin versus Equifax. Their checkbook and wallet was stolen, and someone went and opened up fake checking accounts and incurred fake debts in their name. We do not know what happened here. And that's what we're protecting here, is the hypothetical, unsophisticated consumer who gets this letter. Not just Ms. McMillan, but anybody else who gets this letter that says, if you don't pay this debt, ergo, you're dishonest, which is what this letter boils down to. I think on its face, this letter is actionable. But at the very minimum is what we're talking about here. We had a right to present a consumer survey. And that is the crystal clear teachings of this court in Walker, Marshall Mosby, et cetera.
What the questions were you going to ask in that survey?
Well, you would present the consumer this letter, have them read it. We'd hire a survey firm.
And then ask what?
What conclusion do they draw about paying this debt?
Do you find this insulting? Or
no, you don't ask them the ultimate conclusion. You ask them... What do you infer or what do you understand if you do not pay this debt? And you gauge those responses. And if the responses are that I'm dishonest or I'm crooked or I did something wrong or bad, and a significant fraction of the population comes to that conclusion, we present that to the trier of fact. That's something we've been doing recently in other fair debt cases. It's very expensive, but it's something we were willing to do here. We tried to do it in Durkin Equifax through a linguist. The linguist got struck, and now we're back to trying to do these consumer surveys. And you hire a marketing firm, and they go out to a mall like Orland Square Mall in Orland Park, and they intercept consumers. If anybody's been out shopping, there are people out there with clipboards that survey consumers for all kinds of things. It could be whether they like, Tide versus some other form of detergent, or whether they like A versus B. There are these independent marketing firms that go out and survey for all kinds of reasons, not just litigation reasons. And that's what we think we had an absolute right to do here. The district court criticized us and said, oh, well, Walker and Johnson, all that, those all involve 1692G cases, which are the validation notice. Well, there's no difference between a consumer being confused by language in the validation notice or other language in addition to validation notice, and the consumer being confused as to whether being deceived or misled by a given statement. And that's what this court has held in Durkin, where it said, no, you needed a survey to withstand summary judgment. It's also what this court said in Pettit versus Trevo Masters. You needed a survey to rebut what we think was a clear letter that you lose on. On a motion to dismiss, we had an absolute, we stated a claim. We're not advancing the wild argument that Judge Esposh warned against in that series of cases of, well, are you telling me that if someone said, you owe a debt, please pay, and then had all the statutory notices, and then someone filed suit and said, oh, we think this is deceptive or misleading, you couldn't dismiss it on a motion to dismiss. That's not this case. Okay, this is a case where we explain why we think it's false, deceptive, or misleading. I think it may be a literally false statement, but regardless of that, we don't need to fight that fight with Judge Bauer's concern about is this a literally false statement or not. It's is it deceptive or misleading to a significant fraction of the population as a whole. Are there any further questions? Otherwise, I'll reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll hear now from Mr. Messer.
May it please the Court, Joseph Messer on behalf of Collection Professionals. The starting point is obviously the collection letter and the complaint. The complaint admits that the appellant bounced a check. It's paragraph says five says that the collection letter demanded payment for a dishonor check.
But is that the same thing as an admission? Certainly, the collection letter says that. But I'm concerned that the district court assumed that McMillan wrote a check to a third party which was returned for insufficient funds and didn't cure the bounced check. So that's one concern. But I also have a broader concern. When we get these cases and we have like a letter in front of us and we say that letter's okay, that letter then goes out to everyone. It goes out to the person whose identity is stolen. It goes out to the person who never bounced the check and they just got the wrong client and the wrong name. There are 10 John Smiths in the phone book, and so you sent it to the wrong one. Things like that happen. And so we want these letters to comply with the law. And one part of the law says you shouldn't represent conduct in order to disgrace the person. And so I think the statute was about heavy-handed practices. So these are all concerns that I have about disposing of this case at this early stage, before facts have been introduced at a summary judgment level, for example, which might flesh them out.
Well, Your Honor, it's acceptable for the district court and this court determined in Taylor that it's acceptable for the district court to determine a letter on its face without going beyond.
You can. No, I'm not saying that there's never going to be a case in the world. There are plenty of letters that, indeed, we've suggested language in letters. We say if you follow this language, you're fine. But each particular letter, of course, has to be evaluated on its own, and each case has to be evaluated as to whether the complaint, if any facts could be proven consistent with the allegations of the complaint that would allow the pleader to obtain relief. That's the 12b6 standard. And so my only comments relate to this particular letter on these particular facts.
Well, this letter does not disgrace the consumer. It is
called dishonest, isn't a disgracing.
Well,
sort of
it's
do you
calling
want your name in the New York Times dishonest person.
It is calling into question the person's honesty because
sure.
They bounced the check, and it's giving them an opportunity, not necessarily.
Isn't that an offensive thing to do? Instead of just saying you've bounced a check, pay.
Well, Your Honor, you should. Importantly, this is not the initial communication. The initial communication contains the validation requirement and the ability of the consumer to contest the debt.
But why is this not within the language? If taking it on its face, presenting this dichotomy, you're either honest or dishonest, you cannot be both. Maybe I know a lot of people who bounce checks, who just paid the $30 fee or whatever it is these days that banks charge and send out a good check, and they were just careless or negligent and had no dishonesty at all.
But certainly, Your Honor, it does leave the avenue open for the person being honest. Say, for instance,
But this letter doesn't. I mean, to get a letter, I would, not that I'm the standard, but to get a letter accusing me of being dishonest, I would find it very...
Isn't there a section of both the state's attorney's office and the attorney general's office where you go with somebody gave you a bum check?
There was
for many, many years, and I assume there still is, a section of the attorney general's office or the state's attorney's office where you go if you've received a check that was dishonored.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I do know that there's a state statute that allows for... presentment of the check and a time period to pass, and if the person doesn't pay, there's a presumption that it's or there's the ability to get attorney's fees.
Isn't there a knowing requirement in that if you pass the bum check knowing that there were insufficient funds?
Well, there may be that, but I think we're getting away from this collection letter. The letter says you're either honest or you're dishonest.
Right, and that's the problem. No, we're not getting away from it, because the question is there any set of facts consistent with this person's complaint that, if proven, would show a violation of this statute? And the district court assumes in her ruling the facts show that there is this kind of knowing knowing bounced check that isn't cured. And she also makes assumptions about intent to disgrace. and fairness. And I'm just worried at this stage of the litigation.
Well, Your Honor, I think there are various ways a person could respond to this collection letter. It doesn't, if in fact...
Isn't the question what the reasonable, unsophisticated consumer would see in the letter? Not just a totally off-the-wall person, as we've said, but an unsophisticated consumer standard?
But an unsophisticated consumer is not the person at the lowest rung.
I understand that.
And in fact...
I already said that, but isn't...
You know, in the Taylor decision, this court gave district court judges significant discretion. In fact, it said in that case, and this is akin to this consumer survey notion, the fact that a lawyer has found three people who are willing to sign affidavits drafted by him stating that they were confused will not create an issue for trial unless the judge reading the letter reasonably concludes that it could well confuse a substantial number
right,
of recipients.
Right, and that's a confusion standard, and I'm focusing still on whether this is under 1692E7 conduct in order to disgrace. Is your company out there trying to just shame people or disgrace them?
These are 1692E. This is a 1692E and F case. That was
I know,
a G
I said
case.
1692E7 is what this case is in part about.
Right, and I think that the G
line. That's not a confusion standard. That's a disgrace standard.
I think the confusion standard is a more difficult one for a collection agency to overcome when somebody alleges confusion. There's more case law that says that, yes, somebody might be entitled to a consumer survey here in such a case. But in an E or F case, such as this case, the case law does not say that, and the district court is allowed to review the letter itself and make a determination, just as the lower court did in this case, that it's not a deceptive letter and it's not a... It does not disgrace the consumer. Again, because in this situation, the consumer has various options.
Would you consider it if somebody published an article in the newspaper about you saying that you were dishonest? Would you consider that libelous?
Well, if I was dishonest, no, I wouldn't because...
Well, you'd have there'd be a truth defense. The allegation is made, you are dishonest.
Certainly, I understand that.
And would you or would you not consider that a libelous allegation?
If it was not true that I was dishonest, I would say that that could rise to libel, certainly.
Okay.
But that's not what this letter says. This letter's saying you either are or you're not. You know, it's inviting an explanation. It's inviting a response. And importantly,
the only way you can prove you're honest is by paying, though, whether or not you owe the debt.
I would disagree with
Your
Honor.
We would like to give you this final opportunity to prove your honesty and good intentions. Payment in full or satisfactory arrangements for payment must be made without further delay. The only way to prove you're honest is to pay.
If this letter was combined as the initial communication with the validation notice, there might be an overshadowing type situation. But that letter has already gone out to the consumer, and they've either not responded to it or disregarded whatever. But they have the ability under the Fair Debt Act. That's the reason for the validation
notice.
Not
revealed in this letter, certainly.
No, it's not. This is not the initial communication. That's the reason. This is a subsequent communication that goes out after the 30-day period has expired, and the consumer has had the ability to contest the debt and demand proof of the debt if, in fact, they disagree with it. That didn't occur, so this letter goes out. And in this letter, the collection agency and the client are making certain assumptions, which I would maintain are reasonable under the circumstances of a bounced check. When you write a check and you don't have enough money in your account, it is true that you could have made a mistake. However, you wrote that check, and you have to do something about it to put yourself in the honest camp. If, in fact, you're going to stand on it and say, well, I made a mistake, and that's okay. At the time, I thought I was okay, but now I realize that I don't have money in the account, and I'm just going to thumb my nose at it, I say you're being dishonest. And that's the concept of this letter. It's saying you're either honest or dishonest when you wrote the dishonest check. And they have no reason to believe that it's a false identity situation or any other circumstance because they never got a communication back in response to the initial communication, which had the validation notice in it. But again, the Taylor court, I think the most important decision here for the court to focus on is the Taylor decision, where the court made clear that in a reading of a letter, the district court needs to determine that a significant percentage of the population would be misled. This, again, is not a confusion case, but Taylor is the closest case the court can look to.
Thank you, Mr. Messer.
Thank you.
We have a minute left, Mr. Phillips.
Just a couple quick points. I lost the Taylor case, so I know what was alleged and not alleged there. And there we made the mistake of standing on the letter. We never said we wanted to produce any evidence. We thought the letter on its face violated the law. So this is not the Taylor case. That was a motion for judgment on the pleadings, different standard, not a motion to dismiss. Second point, this letter, as Your Honors have pointed out, isn't just Ms. McMillan. It's the letter to people as a whole. And in fact, pending in the district court right now is a class action called Shooter versus McMillan, or versus Collection Professionals before Judge St. Eve, where the debt at issue is a dental debt. They use the same letter regardless of whether it's a bounce check that concerns Judge Bauer or a medical debt that you can't pay for whatever reason. So that's the harm. That's the evil. It's how this letter is used to people across the board, not just for a bounce check, as we've colloquially termed it. And in fact, you know, maybe you did make a mistake initially when you bounced the check for various reasons. A check that you relied on bounced. You're not good at math. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons. Okay? And then, when everything hits the fan, as it were, you can't correct it because of whatever reasons are causing you financial trouble. You lost your job. You got divorced. You lost your medical benefits.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to both Mr. Phillips and Mr. Messer, and the case will be taken under advisement.